Balcony's first ever year-round bourbon was an inspiration. It all had to work together. A blend of carefully selected ingredients, Texas-sized pot stills, and creative people determined to find the absolute best way to usher a new whiskey along. When you discover how it pairs with a meaningful moment, suddenly the feeling of drinking great whiskey becomes a whole lot more.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Whiskey Neat, Spirited Conversations with Interesting People. I am your host, Christopher Hart. Now, today on the show, we sit down with someone I'm very excited to talk to, Mr. D.B. Woodside. D.B. Woodside is, he's probably most famous from Lucifer, but I first saw him as the principal in Buffy, one of my favorite shows in the 90s. I get to sit down with him to talk about both part two of season five of Lucifer, as well as the final season, and we're going to do it over a few drinks. I'm really excited to talk to him, and it's going to be fun. I want to give a quick shout out to a brand new sponsor for the show. Whiskey Neat is brought to you in part by Legend Bourbon, a first of its kind, super premium bourbon that melds Kentucky distilling tradition with Japanese blending excellence. Order a bottle in your area via drizzly.com, and please, 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 drink smart. Additionally, of course, you know one of my favorite sponsors, Amrut Indian Whiskey. They're doing so well. They've been trending like crazy. And I'm not going to say it's our fault, and I'm not going to say it's due to our listeners, but Amrut's been on a trend globally. I think it's like the number three trending international whiskey. They're absolutely killing it. This year, the International Wine and Spirits Competition gave Amrut Fusion 95 points, and Amrut specifically would like to thank our listeners for being part of its success. Without further ado, please welcome Mr. D.B. Woodside from Netflix's Lucifer. Cheers. First off, let me say, I know you're known for Lucifer, and I cannot wait to jump into Lucifer, and we definitely will. But one of my favorite things, I was going to ask, what do you get most recognized for that people always mention? Because for me, it's Buffy. For me, I was like, I was such a Buffy fan, and I know you've done a lot of serious stuff, both before and after that. But Lucifer and Buffy are the supernatural. To me, it's the most fun.
Yes. Yeah. It depends on where I am. And it used to be, at least before Netflix was a really big thing. It was definitely for Buffy and for Lucifer. But when Netflix started to blow up, and I don't know why, because I know that Suits isn't on Netflix, so I'm not exactly sure how the world changed. But whenever I would fly, go into anywhere in Europe or other countries, they would recognize me for Suits, which was really interesting.
Oh yeah, well, I've watched Suits from the very beginning, and when I found out I was going to interview you, I actually went back because I haven't seen the last couple seasons. I didn't see when you left, and so I went back and we're still in somewhat of a COVID era. I spent an entire Saturday watching all of season five. So Suits is great. Don't get me wrong. I'm a huge fan, but to me, it's hard to let go of the principal from Buffy. You know, it's one of those early childhood memories. This whiskey's great, by the way.
Yeah. So this is the Whistle Pig 10, right?
Yeah, they're based out of Vermont. This is the Whistle Pig 10 year. It's a rye whiskey, and huge fans. We're actually doing a whole hog roast with them in a couple of weeks for our group. And I talk about this on the show a little bit, but the largest North American whiskey group's here in Houston. It's 11,000 people, and we're throwing a pig roast for 75 of them. So it was an instant sellout, of course, but Whistle Pig will be there. And yeah, we're definitely huge fans. Let's see here. I know we talked about it before we started recording, but I want to come back to it. Coleman Domingo. I just want to give him an on-air shout out. I was going through an article, an interview that you did, and in the advertisements, I saw a picture of Coleman, and he, of course, he's been on the show. And I stumbled across a tweet where you were talking about how great of an actor he is. Yeah. And I couldn't agree more. I'm just such a huge Coleman Domingo fan. And you guys have worked together on Lucifer too. So that was a kind of a weird kismet lineup.
Yeah. But here's the thing. Like, we worked on the same show, but I was really jealous because I never got a chance to work with him. It was one of those things where he was the number one guest star in what they call the A storyline. And I think I was the B storyline that episode. So, and we were shooting up in Vancouver. So I never got a chance to actually work with him. We all went out. I think one night, I think it was, it might've been, Leslie Ann's birthday, and we all had a huge dinner, and went out up there in, Vancouver. The next time that I saw him, was about 2 years ago. I was doing a play, at the Geffen, and, you know, I love theater. I come from theater. It's, you know, born and raised in New York. It's just in my blood. And we were doing this amazing play called Skeleton Crew. And our director, Patricia McGregor, is really close friends with Coleman. I think they have a few projects that they've written together. And so she told us one night that he was coming. And because I'm such a fan of his work, I was overwhelmed with nerves. I'm having all kinds of, like, you know, panic attack in the back. And I think that's how it is with actors that you love, you know, you want to impress them, right? Like you want to get that hug or that love from them. And we had a really great show that night. He was there and he was just so nice. And, you know, I think I was a little, I didn't know what to say. And I think that's sometimes what people don't understand. I mean, yeah, we're actors, but we're also blown away by other actors and we're fans. So sometimes when you're meeting, you know, one of your, idols, you kind of freeze up and you don't really know what to say. So I'm sure I sounded like an idiot when I was talking to him. It's one of those moments where I think I was walking out of the theater to head to parking after it was over. And I was just trying to replay the conversation back in my head. And I was like, oh man, I think I sounded like an idiot. I think I was just, you know, just felt so stupid. But it's just because I love that guy's work. He's so dynamic. So incredible.
There's such a gravity to his delivery.
Yeah.
Right. Like with the way he talks, the way he speaks, there's a gravity in his voice. And as we talked about off air, I mean, the Euphoria performances have just been brilliant, brilliant. Yeah, it's something that, you know, I'm on social media and these things, and it's not, you know, it's fun. But when I got a notification that Coleman was following me, I was like, a little bit of heart flutter, right? Like, just like this little bit of, God, it's so cool. He's such a cool
absolutely.
Dude.
Yeah.
By the way, I wanted to tell you I guess we could move on to the next pour here. I guess we could start with this 12 or go next to this 12. I think we should have, at the very least, raise a glass to you because I heard you recently died.
I died.
Did you not hear about the celebrity death hoax about Mr. DB Woodside passing?
No.
Yeah. Apparently I was, you know, in my research of you, there was this, mini panic attack just maybe a month ago online where people thought that you had passed because of a Facebook post. And, I thought it's, you know, you've made it whenever celebrity death hoax takes you, you know?
Oh my God. I would love to know what this post was. I'd never heard anything about it.
I'll send it to Aaron. But, you've worked, and going through your IMDb page, you've worked nonstop. It seems like your phone has to constantly be ringing. And to have that kind of impact where someone goes out of their way to lie about your death for likes or retweets or something, it's a badge of honor, buddy.
Well, thank you. No, I'm very much alive and kicking. And, you know, if I have anything to do with it, I'll be here for quite some time. I have an 11-year-old, you know, I gotta be around to at least she hits 40. So, you know.
Yeah. I saw that you, you've got one daughter, you're right in that pre teenager space. I did want to ask, are you a little nervous about the teenage years? Are you looking for, I mean, there's all this stereotyping. I've got four, two are 15 and 16, and then two are babies.
Okay. So you, yeah.
Yes, I've been through it, but I remember when they were little, everybody's like, just wait, you got pretty girls, you better watch out, you know? You been nervous at all about the teenage years?
I mean, nervous in different ways, you know? I think what I've been going through lately is those ages, because I have a little girl, and I think when you're a dad, to have a little girl is such a blessing. Not to say that having boys isn't, but having a little girl, being a dad is such a blessing, because there's a love that little girls have for their dads. And so I was just talking to a really good friend of mine a few days ago. My daughter's 11, going on seems 30. And I miss that time when, you know, you would pull up to school. And it didn't matter what kind of day I was having. I could have had a terrible day at work. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, how am I going to be able to hide this from my daughter? I don't feel like talking. I'm just in a terrible mood. But I got to show up for her, because that's what you do as a parent. You show up for your kids no matter what kind of mood you're in. And I show up and I'm thinking I'm in the worst mood possible. And I walk into the courtyard. She sees me. And she does that mad dash all the way across the courtyard without breaking a stride and leaps into my arms. Within 5 minutes, I couldn't remember why I was in a bad mood, right? Because that's all that matters. You know, she's with her little spindly arms, you know, choking the shit out of me, you know, because she doesn't know her own strength yet. It's just, I cherish all of those times. You know, it's amazing, because you think, okay, well, today's going to be the day that she doesn't do it. But every day, that was her go-to for years. And so when that stops, you know, because they're growing up and they're, you know, trying to, you know, exert their independence, which is healthy and normal, I think it breaks our hearts. You know, you of course want them to be independent. But there's also that part of you that, you know, you miss that time. And so I'm lucky that I have friends that have older children who always told me, you know, really tune in during that time, because I guarantee you it will change and you're going to miss that time. And she's wonderful. I mean, like, I have to say her mom and I are blessed, because she innately is just such a good child. But yeah, you know, I mean, she's a preteen now, doesn't think dad and mom are, you know, cool anymore. And, you know, is focused on, you know, her phone and her friends. And it seems to me every 2 days, there's another falling out with her best girlfriend, and they're not talking. And then they're talking 2 days later. And I have to say the little girl drama is intense. And, you know, I do my best to just allow her to be who she is and just listen. But it's a, as you know, it's a roller coaster ride, you know.
So at some point over the last couple of years, someone had mentioned to me that there comes a time in which you set your daughter down and you never pick her back up. And you often don't realize when that happens. It's usually after. And it broke my heart. Just the thought that I don't remember when that transition is with our 15 and 16-year-olds. I don't remember when they didn't jump into my arms. Like, I don't remember when the cutoff was. And if I knew that it was going to be the last time, I would have hugged them a little deeper, you know? It messes with your head. This is a weird segue, but that's kind of what I got from Aminadil's struggle with his child, right? Making the transition to Lucifer now. The season, or the first part of the season, that that intense fear of what, well, and spoiler alert a little bit, you know, for those who haven't seen it, I'll give you a second to mute me. But the nothing will make you, one of the things they don't warn you about as a parent is you have these intense scenarios play out in your head while your kid's playing, right? Like if our kid's playing near the fireplace and they're a little clumsy and a little off their, you know, they're not quite balanced and not quite strong enough. And you always imagine, oh, don't hit your head or don't trip and fall. And I've never imagined all the different ways that my kids could get severely injured until I became a father. And Aminadil goes through that, where he has this moment where he realizes what his child's going to go through. And as a father myself, it comes across very true.
Yeah, I think, you know, he's been a really interesting character for me to play. And, you know, season five, I think it finds him really trying to figure out what it means to be a dad. I think he's really lost. And I think Amenadiel's been lost for quite some time. And so I think he finds purpose in being a dad. And now he's trying to just figure out what the best way is to go about being a father to this half angel, half human child. So I think and this is a spoiler alert if people haven't seen five, but if you haven't seen 5A, then, you know,
what are you doing with your life?
Exactly. Come on.
We've been in lockdown. You should have binged everything.
Exactly. Twice. I think he becomes really freaked out when he finds out that his baby is human, for all kinds of reasons. I think for him, he thinks about the fact that his child could get sick, grow old, die, all these things that, you know, we as human parents worry about every day, you know? So I think he's being faced with, again, in a very different way, faced with his child's mortality and how is he supposed to go about protecting his child from all the dangers out there in the world.
One of the things I wanted to ask you that with a show this popular and with you being so involved in social media about theories, and, you know, there's been times where a news outlet will tweet something and you would reply and correct them and say, no, that's not true. Do you follow or look into fan theories a lot? And do you ever see one that's right that you kind of get a little excited for, right? Like I'm about to tell you one that's out there, and I understand you can't confirm anything, but has there been times in the popularity of the show where you have seen a fan theory that you know is true, but has not been announced yet? There's no way they could know. It's really just a fan theory that's actually accurate.
I mean this with all the love and respect that I can muster up. What's really been interesting about this show is I have never seen a fan theory that's been correct. Not one time. And that's incredible. I've seen some that have come close, but I've never seen one that's been correct. There is one, there is something so huge that happens in 5B that I have to be honest, I'm shocked that it hasn't come out, it hasn't leaked, it hasn't, that no one has any idea. And so what I would just say, and I've been saying this since we're gonna, you know, drop in about 10-9 days here, people, you better bring a box of Kleenex, because I just promise you that you're going to need it. Just bring that box of Kleenex, because you're not going to see this coming. So.
Oh, that's brutal. That's brutal. The fan theory that I was referring to is I watched a video in which they were covering your child. The show is leaning towards that the child is human, but we've seen Lucifer specifically lose his powers at time, become mortal at time. Is there a chance that the your child's angelic abilities just haven't kicked in yet?
And,
You know, puberty hits all of a sudden, invincible.
Right. Well, here's the thing. I would say never say never, right? There's always a possibility. That's all I'll say. I'll say never say never. But
try to be careful.
Yes, I do have to be careful. But whether it happens or not, a meningeal will work through whatever's going on with him. And that particular topic comes up between Amenadiel and God in season 5B. So Amenadiel and God do discuss this, and I don't think it goes the way that Amenadiel had been hoping.
Before we get to God, which I am so excited to talk to you about. And I know you've been talking about it quite a bit, so I'm sure you're exhausted by this point. I'm gonna pour something else here. So one of the things I sent you was a Kentucky bourbon called Legend. That is the interesting bottle there. The company.
Let me see here. I'm looking at all of them. I think I'm being, here it is. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. So that bottle, the company that owns Beam, basically, they have a sister company in Japan. It's all owned by the same parent company. So Japanese blending is very popular. Kentucky bourbon is obviously very popular. So they had a Japanese blender blend a Kentucky bourbon, which is kind of the clashing of two worlds. And I thought that would be a great segue into discussing God and Mr. Dennis Haysbert.
Oh my God. First of all, I never get tired of talking about Dennis, because he is honestly one of my favorite people. He's just an amazing, amazing man. An extremely talented artist. And I cannot wait for people to see him playing God. I really can't.
Yeah. Well, his appearance in the show was done in such a, I feel like in a jaw-dropping way. There's this, everyone on the show and everyone in real life who's ever been religious has struggled with the fact that God doesn't speak to us, right? Through prayer, through even someone like Lucifer, where you're all trying to make sense of God's will. Dennis is, to me, he's iconic, and it's everything he's been in has been something that I've loved seeing him in. He's got this same thing as Coleman, this gravity to his delivery, and honestly, in a very heartwarming way. I had this pastor growing up who I grew up super religious in a Pentecostal religion, and I'm not practicing anymore. No bash against them or anything, but
I did too, by the way. So
you grew up Pentecostal?
No, I grew up very religious. I'm not anymore, and I don't bash, but it's just right. Something that I needed to go a different way.
My pastor, though, was this older, he was in his 70s when I was growing up, and he had this way about him that it, with your parents, you want to lie in your formative years. You want to sneak out. You want to explore the world, but you're afraid you're going to get in trouble. So you lie to them. And my pastor had this way about him that you could come to him and talk to him and you didn't feel judgment. You didn't feel shame. It was just this all encompassing love. And that is how I think 5A ends, is you can feel the love. Like there's something about his delivery on camera that was just so warming, despite the fact that he's got the light coming from behind him and that sort of thing. But he's so fantastic. But I heard a rumor online that actually Tom Ellis was originally vying for Tom Hanks to be God. Is that
true? Here's the thing. Here's the thing. And now that the show is over, I'll let this slip a little bit more. I have been a little bit. I think there were. I know there were a lot of people that they were throwing around for the idea of God. We've been talking about who could possibly be God since, honestly, since season one. I kept saying Dennis. I kept saying Dennis. Every year I would talk about Dennis. There were other people thrown around. I won't, you know, confirm or deny who, but there were other people constantly being thrown around. I kept holding to Dennis. Finally, when we got to right before this season, and they were talking about finally bringing in God. Also, by the way, because we thought it was going to be our last season. So that's something else. That what I then found out was there were two writers also, and I have to give them a shout out, Mike Costa and Chris. Oh, why am I blanking on Chris's last name right here? Mike Costa and Chris Rafferty. Two amazing writers. And they were also fans of Dennis's work in 24. So I had heard that they too were pushing Dennis from their side. So I think the holy trinity of us three convinced people that Dennis was the right person. I happened to be out, you know, it was one of those Emmy weekends where there are parties all over the place. And I was out with my manager, Myrna Jacoby, here in Los Angeles. And I saw Dennis at this party and I went over to him. I hadn't seen him probably, 5 or 6 years. And, you know, it was just great to see him. And I pulled him aside and I said, listen, there's a chance that they're going to bring God to Lucifer this season. I want you to do it. I know some other people are interested. If we really pushed hard, is this something that you would do? And he looked at me, he smiled, and he said, yeah. And that was it for me. After you know, he gave me the okay. I think the three of us just kept pecking away. And they checked Dennis's availability. And Dennis came on, and just episode after episode, scene after scene, just blew people away. So that's the Dennis Haysbert story.
Is there a Marvel DC character you've always wanted to play, you know, that you would just jump at? There's got to be. I know there's something there for you.
Yeah, listen, I've been vocal about this, so I have wanted to play the version John Stewart, the Green Lantern for.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
God knows how long I've been talking about this. I just see him as someone who's grizzled, working through shit issues. He is, in my opinion, a superhero that is in his 40s. And there's just something about that character that I've always wanted to play. I think he's absolutely incredible. I've also been fascinated by, I grew up with the Luke Cage Power Man. I know Netflix did that, and I'm a big fan of Mike's, you know. I think he's great. But if we're talking about taking into the Marvel Universe, maybe the movies, that's something I would love to possibly revisit. But for me, it's always been John Stewart, Green Lantern. My dad was a military guy, you know, or he went in and came out. He wasn't a fan of the military at the time he was in there, being a black man during that time. He had I think the military gave him this type of discipline.
Mentality.
Yes. And that's how he raised us. And so I think there's something about that and the mentality of this guy, John Stewart, that to this day, I would love to play. I would love to play.
Fun fact for those who are even remotely comic book fans. There's two superheroes that always speak to my youth, and it's Superman, classic, and Green Lanterns. John Stewart, specifically, for those who don't know, you essentially have a power ring that you can create objects with your will, right? Like you can create a hammer or a gun. But those constructs are typically hollow.
Right.
John Stewart is the only Green Lantern who would build those constructs at every fundamental level. The bolts, if he were to make a gun, it's not just a hollow gun. The bolts, the screws, every piece he builds as if it's a real object.
Yeah.
And that's why a lot of his constructs are superior in every possible way. I'm a huge John Stewart fan. So to hear that, and to hear, well, one, I've done a tremendous amount of research on you in the past couple of weeks, but I didn't know that about you. I didn't know that you had even spoken on being a Green Lantern. So that's apparently yeah. I haven't been doing good research.
That's something that I've wanted to do, that I've been very vocal about for years, at least vocal on Twitter and in some interviews. You know, I don't know what's happening over there on HBO Max, but I know they're coming out with a series, and you know, so I don't know what's happening, but that's always been something that I've really been interested in. So, you know, we'll see. One can only, you know, hope and pray and throw it out there in the universe.
So while we move on to our next pour, I want to talk to you about your directorial debut. Now, I know you directed a short a few years ago, but this was your first foray in like big production directing. Yeah. So let me see if I'm going to go ahead and pour this Whistlepig 18, only because I have never had it. And
Whistlepig 18.
It's the pretty bottle, very pretty bottle, with the big fat cork. Did you get one?
I.
It's okay. It's okay if you don't have it.
Whistlepig 15, Whistlepig 6, Whistlepig 12, 2 Whistlepig 10s.
Uh-oh. It's okay, though. Okay. Grab the green bottle that says the Prideful Goat. It's actually my bourbon.
Really?
Yeah, me and my partner, Randall Sullivan, right. and Carlos Daldecoa, we started a spirits brand, a bourbon brand that's 15-year-old Kentucky. It's a great pour. And so let's talk about, I know you've done some talking. I read a couple of great interviews and you discussing the difficult nature in directing an episode. And I'm curious, I know how hard it was for Tom this season to play two roles. It had to be damn near impossible. But I've always wondered, if you are in an episode and you're directing it, how difficult that's got to be in terms of how does it work? If you're in the middle of a moment and you're not watching a monitor, so you can't see the whole picture, you're in the scene, right? So do you just say cut, or do you just say, hey, this is not right, let's start from top? I mean,
I think everybody does it differently. I mean, what I will say is I was really lucky, and everyone from top to bottom on the production really looked out for me. And what I mean by that is, The writers were so amazing that I didn't have to worry too much about being in this episode, the one that I was directing. Amenadiel is only in the very beginning and the very end.
Okay.
So I got to really put that hat on as a director and just have that experience. I'd probably say 95% of the time. But when I was in a scene, I'll be honest, it was a little weird. I mean, I think there are, three scenes that I'm in, and you're standing there and you're watching everyone else's performance and you're seeing what the camera is doing. And, I don't know about other actors, but right now, I mean, this is early in my directing career. Right now I had to make a choice, and for me, I would rather, you know, be an okay actor in my directing debut than be an okay director, you know? I was never able to turn off my directing brain, which is a good thing, because I think the episode really turned out well.
Was there, it's not quite the penultimate episode of the series, but it's right before that. Was there how does that work? Do they approach you and say, we'd like you to direct an episode? Or do you say, hey, before this is done, I'd love to do one? How did that setup happen?
Well, this started back in season one. Nathan Hope, who was our first year, we were located in Vancouver. And Nathan Hope was up there with us. Nathan Hope in the first season was our producer director, you know, which means he was really kind of responsible for the directors coming in. And Nathan is the director that's directed the most of Lucifer, fantastic. The very first episode, Nathan and I had worked together many, many years ago. He was the DP on, they're just doing a reboot of it right now, CSI. And he said to me during, I think it was the second episode, that I really should be directing. And it's something that I'd always wanted to do and had been trying to do on several different shows, but for various reasons, always met some type of resistance. But when you're on a show that's going to be on for a while, you know, I just kept knocking on that door every year, and every year I would knock on it a little bit louder. And I think by the time we got to season four, I had some assistants knocking on that door, and Nathan was knocking on the door with me, as was Christiane Reed from Bruckheimer. So I think it was the three of us knocking on that door. And finally, they decided to open the door. And I think there's a lot of, you know, I think Hollywood runs on a lot of fear, you know. So I'm a known entity as an actor. So I think there's some, you know, when someone is trying to step over into another area, I think it makes people nervous.
Hesitant, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So it did take some persuading. I'm just really thankful and really happy that it finally happened, because I also think the best place for it to happen would be on a show like this, where I know everyone, we have a relationship, we all love each other. And that's the best environment to really start from.
Well, one of the things that is quite common in within the whiskey world is barrel selections, right? Like a distillery invites you out, they line up a bunch of barrels and you taste through a bunch, and you are solely responsible for picking the best of the lineup. And when that bottle gets to you and people taste it and drink it, it's hard to be objective because it's your baby, right? And it's hard to know whether or not it's actually good, if you did a good job. Was there some nervousness in the final product? I'm sure you watched that episode. Did you approach some of your co-stars and ask them, what do you think of the episode? Was there some nervousness in the final product, or did you feel good about it throughout?
I don't want this to sound terrible. I think it's different. If I didn't feel that I could put together a show with people that I loved from,
I rock that shit. That's what you're trying to say. No, I killed it.
I think there's, what I'll say is this, respectfully and humbly, I am happy with what I created. But it's because I think, you know, I was given a great opportunity. I mean, I was given a really great script. And so it's not like, you know, maybe with a whiskey, you know, it's just you and someone else. But with a television show, you have dozens to hundreds of people that are not going to let you fail. They are not going to let you fail. So
you're given the tools.
Yes. I mean, they create an environment for success. And so I was very fortunate that way. I'm given a fantastic script with amazing actors. And I think the number one thing as a director, the directors that I love, when you're given a great cast with a great script, what a smart director knows is you have to get the fuck out of the way. Get out of the way. You know, let these talented people go to work. they don't really need you kind of getting in there and mucking with their process. What they need you to do is be a sounding board. What they need is for you to be a, what I call someone who's shaping what they bring, right? You're not having to invent anything. Great actors are going to go home. They're going to come in and they're going to give you three or four different choices. It's your job as a director to look at those choices, to pick one and to shape it according to the story, according to the words on the page. So yes, I hope it doesn't sound terrible. But I am, what I should say is I am proud of this episode. I think everyone who worked on it should also be proud. And I'm looking forward to the next opportunity.
Yeah, I think, I don't think anyone would call you braggartly. I think you come across very humble. And I couldn't be more excited. I mean, this is the show, obviously, at times has taken a serious tone, but has also given way to a lot of levity, a lot of, everything from, I hear this upcoming season will have a musical number in it, right? Like, you know, so I...
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, so it's one of those things.
You guys are going to love that. I'm telling you. You guys are really going to love that episode. It's hilarious. It's great. It's also heartbreaking.
Oh, more tears.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
One of the things I sent you, and it should be in front of you, it's that old bottle. Listen, I said this already. Your career has spanned almost 30 years, and you have worked it seems like nonstop you've been working. That bottle was bottled the year you were born.
Oh, my God.
In 1969. So the liquid has been sitting in that bottle. I know people are tired of hearing me. I know Jack is tired of hearing me giving the spiel on these things, but it's a birth year bottle. I have a whiskey festival here, and we do a lot of that's called a dusty, something that's been around for a long time that's literally collected dust. It was bottled in 1969, the year you were born, and the liquid I thought would be so cool to send your way after all this time, 51 years in the bottle, for you to drink and taste. There's no promise it's good, but Old Crow is an iconic brand, and that's definitely a good one. I actually had two of them, so I figured we could share it together. This one's also bottled the year you were born, but I already opened this one with Coleman.
All right, well, cheers, my friend.
Here we go. Cheers, buddy. Cheers to you.
Oh, wow.
Old Crow is an iconic brand. And these little travel bottles, going back to your suits days, these bottles were meant for your suitcase to take to work. They were Mad Men style suitcase bottles.
Oh, wow. That's intense. That's really intense. That's nice.
Well, I wanted you to enjoy it. Before I let you go, let's take a quick moment to talk about the show has gone through a lot of ups and downs, going over to Netflix, 5A, 5B, 5B being the end of it, and then all of a sudden season 6 comes out, which yeah. as the fans are so, myself included, so excited. And if you can't say, we can work around the answer here, but is there enough left open by the end of the show that we may get kind of a Deadwood style movie in a couple of years, you know, like a Netflix film? The show's over, season 6 is done. There's still some, you know, what's going on with Chloe? What's going on? What's happening? And then all of a sudden, 3 years from now, we see a Breaking Bad style follow up to Lucifer.
Here's what I'll say. I'll say that if we never do another episode or movie, everyone is going to be thoroughly satisfied that this. The series has a very solid beginning, middle, and end, and that you can rely on your imagination comfortably about what happens to each of these characters for the rest of their lives. Now, that being said, we have joked and talked about.
Here we go.
Wanted to leave some things open for, look, nowadays, everyone likes to see people coming back together, right?
Absolutely.
So
still waiting on Friends.
Right. I wouldn't be shocked if in, let's say 5 years, maybe 10, if they did some special episode, 2 hour, where they bring the Scooby-Doo back together again.
Oh, there we go. That's what I was hoping for.
You know,
and you would do it.
I would do it. Yeah, of course. This has been listen. I've said this. I've said it to every person in this cast. Rachel has too. We're like the big, aunt and uncle, because we've been around for a while. This is an experience unlike anything that I've ever had in my career. It's been an absolute joy. Even our lows have been
relationship building
on other shows. You know, I mean, you had a show that was shipped off to Vancouver that, and bless them, that, you know, Fox didn't really believe in, and that we kept chugging along, and that no one was giving us a chance. And we just kept coming back. And this show has been through so many ups and downs that we really are a great, big, dysfunctional, loving family. And it's truly been a blessing and a blessing. And it's been such a pleasure to really work with everyone. And I don't just mean the cast. I also mean the writers. I also mean the showrunners, Joe, Ildi, Netflix, Warner Brothers, Bruckheimer. Everyone has been truly wonderful. And I just don't, you know, I don't know if that happens again. I'm definitely going to shoot for it in my career, but I just want everyone to know, and the fans as well, how truly blessed that we all have been.
And I know no one has any control over this, but 3 to 5 years, that'd be the perfect spot. 3 years from now, 5 years from now, to basically say Lucifer Netflix films in the works. And listen, if anyone's good at knocking on, if there's anything to take away from this entire interview, is that you're good at knocking on doors. My recommendation to you is to start knocking now.
But start knocking now, huh?
3 to 5 years. DB, I mean this, man. I wonder, your Hollywood is so used to hearing, I have a fan, and the show has got so many. I mean, I've seen some of the artwork, the incredible artwork of people just drawing you in the show. And I think, Jesus, what an impact. What an impact. I'm a fan. I'm not a good drawer, but I, you know, but I'll send you some free booze, but I'm rooting for a movie. You know, I think God. And plus I don't know her name, but she was also in Suits with you. Amenadiel's, I don't know the actress's name. The mother of your, well, I know the
Rachel.
Yes. She was so great in Suits. And she's so great in the show. I would love to see what's, you know, the baby's now 5, right? A few years down the line. Now the baby's levitating in her sleep a little bit, you know, or I know it's a boy on the show, but it's a female actor. It would be great to see a show. So, I won't take up too much more of your time. I did send you one last bottle, but we can skip it for now. It's the Balcones. Going back to
Balcones.
It should have a little cartoon character on the side.
The Texas single malt whiskey.
Yeah. So one of the things, going back to barrel selections, this is one of them. We went up to the distillery. They rolled out a bunch of barrels. That's a single malt out of Texas, but it is a It's going to put some hair on your chest and maybe the top of your head too. It's a beast of a spirit. Balcones, Texas single malt. We absolutely love it. That one's called Sneaky Pete because we released it in quietness.
Ooh. Yeah. Oh, that one's okay. Wow.
Yeah. Well, listen, I can't thank you enough for doing the show. I look forward to seeing season 5B and of course season 6 and of course the movie in 3 to 5 years. Thank you so much for doing this, DB.
Thank you very much. And I want to just thank you guys for sending me all this whiskey. I'm going to put it to good use. I promise you that. This is fantastic. And it all is amazing. It tastes amazing. So I can't wait to start having some friends over and sitting down and talking some shit while we drink some of this lovely, lovely whiskey that you guys have sent. So thank you very much.
Absolutely. And I'll add this little final note, that one you just tasted, anything that high of proof, the trick is to take smaller and smaller sips until your mouth adjusts. Cause it is, I think, almost 70% alcohol.
Oh my God. That's fantastic.
Thanks again. I appreciate it. And of course, thank you to all of your team for setting this up.
Thank you. And thank you to Aaron. Cheers, guys.
Aaron. Thanks. Cheers.
Balcones' first ever year-round bourbon was an inspiration. It all had to work together. A blend of carefully selected ingredients, Texas-sized pot stills, and creative people determined to find the absolute best way to usher a new whiskey along. When you discover how it pairs with a meaningful moment, suddenly the feeling of drinking great whiskey becomes a whole lot more.